The lives and works of the Puritans is explored on today's Reformed Cast, episode number 13, with our very special guest, Dr. Joel Beakey. Please stay with us. Welcome to episode number 13 of Reformed Cast. And this week, we will be discussing the lives in the written works of the Puritans with Dr. Joel Beakey. Dr. Beakey is president and professor of systematic theology and homiletics, as well as the academic dean for students, the Heritage Reformed Congregations, pastor of the Heritage Reformed Congregation in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and has been for the past 20 years, also the editor of Banner of Sovereign Grace Truth, editorial director of Reformation Heritage Books, and the president of Inheritance Publishers, as well as the vice president of the Dutch Reformed Translation Society. Dr. Beakey has, of course, written, co-authored, or edited 50 books and contributed over 1,500 articles to Reformed books, journals, periodicals, and encyclopedia. Dr. Beakey has a PhD from Westminster Theological Seminary in Reformation and Post-Reformation Theology. Hopefully, Dr. Beakey, I got all that correct, and welcome so much to the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and of course, we're discussing your book, Meet the Puritans, a book that you co-authored and has been very helpful to many, and of course, I can personally attest to that, having read through it devotionally, but wanted to talk about your work with the book and the Puritans in general, if we could. And I guess first, how did you, Dr. Beakey, come to the conclusion that a book on the lives of the Puritans in a biographical style was necessary for the Reformed community?
Well, Scott, there are a couple things that were operative here. One was that I felt early on, as I was reading the Puritans, that it was really a great feast, but I didn't know the men behind all these books, and I thought if we could give a personal touch, people could read as a daily devotional, one life a night of a particular Puritan, and move on the next night to another life of a Puritan, and then if beneath it, we could put all the different books that had been printed by that Puritan, it would give them an incentive to also go out and buy some books for Puritans. So I began, actually, in 1986, doing a series of articles set up this way, biography and then book reviews, for the Banner of Truth magazine that I was editing. And it wasn't until 2004 or so, after I had done a number of these articles, that I realized I could collect them all together and put them in a book. And I brought on a co-author, and he helped me with a number of them. And then we brought them all together and spent about a year putting them together into a book.
Right, and I can imagine the difficulty it is to assemble all of the various historical biographical information and bring that into one tome. How did that process unfold? Could you explain maybe a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I actually rewrote all the articles I wrote over the years, and we fine-tuned them, and then we had things fairly ready to go in 2004, and the new Oxford Dictionary of National Biography came out, which is the most professional latest word on things. And so we went back through them all and checked all our facts, all our details with this new, 70 volumes, 68 volumes of ODNB. And we found some new scholarship had come about that we didn't even know of, despite studying the Puritans all my life. And so that took a lot of work. But then eventually we got it all together, and we ran it by several scholars and so on. And, you know, I think we had four proofreaders on the book, and still there were 3-4 dozen mistakes in the book. And then we sold out our first printing of 6,000 copies in 6 weeks. And meanwhile, we had a few other proofers go through it, found a few more mistakes, incorporated those, ran off 9,000 more, and they lasted about a year. And then we ran a third printing maybe a year ago or so, 2 years ago. And so we've sold well over 20,000 now. It's been moving well, still moving. And a lot of people are using it, like you suggested, as a daily devotional.
Yeah, it seemed to lend itself toward that. And when I got the book, I immediately began to think, well, you know, what's the best way to read through this? Because it's not like a, you know, like most books where you have, you know, sections and chapters that kind of unfold. These were individual bios, and of course, you know, you had your appendix and so forth. So I thought, you know, this is a good way of reading through this would be, you know, during morning devotional, and it's really encouraging that way. But when we're thinking about the lives of the Puritans, and I think particularly about colonial America, you know, being here in New England, that immediately comes to my mind. But we know that the Puritans had some difficulty just in their daily living with sickness and so forth. How can that best help us as believers and stand as a living example for us in our pilgrimage?
You mean the fact that they endured so much affliction?
Yes. And that, you know, many of them, and I don't want to give too much away from your book, but many of them, of course, losing wives and children to disease,
right,
and yet still remarrying,
right,
and still moving forward.
Well, I think that they have a lot to teach us about how to cope with affliction, because they went through so many trials themselves. And they often ransacked the scriptures looking for benefits from affliction. For example, they pointed out that in Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, God says, "I will afflict you in order to humble you." Or in Zephaniah 1, verse 12, "I'll afflict you so that you will learn early on what sin is." And as Hosea says, "it will turn you back to God." So they really worked on that for their own soul and discovered all kinds of benefits from affliction. They often wrote about it. So Thomas Brooks, for example, has a book called A Mute Christian Under the Rod. Richard Sibbs, A Bruised Reed. Thomas Boston, A Book on the Lot. William Bridge, Lifting Up for the Downcast, and so on. But he wrote a lot of books on how to cope with affliction, because they did have so much affliction. And I think when you read these books, you immediately feel the depth of what they're saying and how God uses affliction in our lives like a rod, as Psalm 23 says, to put the sheep back in the right path. And therefore, when the Puritans on January 1 each year greeted each other, they didn't say Happy New Year, but they said Blessed New Year. And so what they really meant by that was, I just, not just the way we mean it, I hope everything goes your way this year, but they meant to say, I hope everything goes God's way, and that you might be sanctified through whatever measure of affliction he deems in his wise sovereignty to put upon you this year.
I see. And I know that, of course, a lot of the affliction from what I've read, a great deal of it occurred when they came over to these shores and began to, you know, put down roots here. And I know that the there's always this question about the difference between the Puritans and the Pilgrims. Would you, and I've talked about this a little bit before on the program when we've talked about Puritans, but you would probably be the best person to really answer this. How would you differentiate those two groups, if at all?
Well, the Puritans were less separatistic in their theology and in their practice than were the Pilgrims. They had a lot in common. Both groups were strong on living only by Scripture, by faith alone, and grace alone, and Christ alone, for the glory of God alone. There they saw eye to eye. But the Pilgrims leaned more toward, well, I'd put them as a halfway house sort of between the Puritans and, say, the Amish. They didn't reject society and didn't move about in society at all, but they were more separatistic. They cut ties completely with the Church of England. And the Puritans, even in Massachusetts, still, even though they felt the Church of England had lots of flaws and they were grieving over her, they didn't view themselves as being cut off from England or from the Church. So the Puritans were more mainstream in society. They were more concerned than were the Pilgrims to live all of life to the glory of God, every sphere. They were more concerned about being a God-fearing husband, a God-fearing apprentice, a God-fearing baker, a God-fearing politician than the Pilgrims were. Pilgrims had more focus on just being spiritual and godly. The Puritans had that too. But the Puritans had a more comprehensive vision, and they were more willing to work for the church, greater love for the church as the institution, I think, as well as a greater sense of burden for society and for the various callings in society, such as politicians.
Okay, I see. And what about the, I know with the Pilgrims, there was a lot of, kind of reminded me when you said near the end about the adherence to the values of the church and the importance of the church in the life of the believer. And it just reminded me of a question about congregationalism and how congregationalism developed. And I know that's a whole subject unto itself, but could you briefly tell us about the effect of congregationalism on the Puritans and vice versa, and how that, or the Pilgrims, as it were. I guess there were a lot of Pilgrims involved in that, and that's why I kind of wanted a little bit of clarification, because of the, I think sometimes we can, I think, confuse the groups in our head as far as their polity and that sort of thing. Could you shed any light on that? Am I not asking that as clearly as I might?
Well, Both groups had congregationalists among them. Obviously, the Pilgrims were more radical in their congregationalism. The danger of congregationalism is that it can come to... Well, let me back up. Any system of church politics is open to being abused by the depravity of man. And really, what you want to do, beyond just looking at the scriptures, you want to ask yourself the question, what system of church government most helps subdue that depravity? The hierarchical system, or the Episcopalian system, of Episcopalianism and Roman Catholicism, is a poor choice, because that has a radical hierarchical structure in which power can really tend to corrupt. The problem with congregationalism on the other extreme, the Puritans said, was that if you're just left as a lone ranger, as a pastor, if you aren't careful and you start moving in the wrong direction, there's often no one there to correct you. Pastor, especially in those days, had much more knowledge than his people. And so the pastor was kind of the leader, often not only of the church, but also of the community. And so if the pastor goes awry, and you're in a congregational system, and you don't have Presbyterian gatherings that can have some authoritative impact upon the pastor, the pastor can just lead things in the wrong way, and it's hard to stop him. So it can be a power ploy as well from the congregational perspective. The genius of Presbyterianism, according to the Puritans, is that there's checks and balances. There's a great respect left for the autonomy of the local church, but in the system of churches coming together and giving each other advice and making decisions in unity, It helps preserve individual pastors from becoming too power hungry. It helps churches work together as a group. And they felt that most brought about unity and kept down this kind of gravity that comes with power. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's the way I would look at it.
Oh, very helpful, and that's really strikes to the heart of the issue. And I'm glad you went into some detail on that, because that's sort of what I try to get into with my congregationalist friends, and try to get them to kind of see that why that's important to have those checks and balances. And with the Puritans, most of them being obviously Presbyterian, I know there was some Baptists, but recognizing that because of the depravity of man, there needs to be a government that best suits the reality of that situation. And I thank you for going into the detail on that. That's appreciated. And I wanted to move a little bit to the subject of reading, and the of course we have a great falling short of reading in American Christianity in general, and I suppose in evangelicalism in specific. But if somebody was going to begin reading the Puritans, obviously that's it's like saying, you know, climb that mountain today, kind of a thing. Where would be a good place to start for somebody that really hasn't done a whole lot of reading, done maybe watched a lot of videos and listened to a lot of audio, but hasn't really sat down for any length of time to do any serious reading on anything, yet you want to get them exposed to the piety of the Puritans? What would be a good suggestion for them?
Well, I think, first of all, I would... if I may say, mention a specific book, I would begin them with a book called Living by God's Promises, which James LaBelle and I have just published a few months ago. We're starting a new series of books. Yeah, and Jerry Bridges has done the forewords, and R.C. Sproul has given his endorsement and so on. But the series of the books take a number of Puritan books per book that we're writing on a given subject. This one, the first one, is on God's promises, obviously. So we've taken three or four major Puritan books on that, and we've sifted out the cream of each book and then organized it and told what the Puritans believe on God's promises in a contemporary, easy-to-read way. So if people begin with something like that, something very contemporary, it's just as easy to read as any other book around, and begin to grasp the depth of the Puritans and the spirituality benefit of them, then they can move to step two, which would be to take some of the simplest Puritans and read them in their own writing. And then I would suggest some titles maybe that have been edited just a little bit, that the old words have been removed, but still it's the actual book of the Puritan. Probably a good place to begin is Thomas Watson's Heaven Taken by Storm, or John Flavel, Keeping the Heart, or some books by Bunyan. Obviously, The Pilgrim's Progress is a great book for a beginner to read, and as well as advanced people. And I think also material by Thomas Brooks, like Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices. I would begin with those titles and then move my way upward and eventually tackle more difficult theologians like Jonathan Edwards, Thomas Goodwin, and John Owen. Also, I might add there, don't forget about Matthew Henry. Get his commentary. He's a great Puritan. And Matthew Poole, get his commentary. And then you've got two basic good Puritan commentaries that you can turn to when you're studying the scriptures and find great help from them as well.
Yes, and I can actually attest to Matthew Henry and Matthew Poole in studying for sermons when I was pastoring. Really, really helpful in trying to get your head and heart around a passage. Certainly, those commentaries really a lot of times head and shoulders above some of the other material that, you know, might be out there, at least in my estimation when I've looked at them. And thank you for those recommendations. I know the listeners are going to be helped by that. I know that the Puritan paperbacks also, Dr. Beeke, I have maybe a dozen of those, and I don't know what you think about those. I thought that they, you know, some of the titles that you mentioned are included in that set, and they seem to be pretty helpful in tackling some of the Puritans' writings in a kind of a smaller bite size.
Yes, I should add as well that all of these books and all the books we're talking about are available from us at Reformation Heritage Books, where we're a nonprofit. We've actually got 3,500 titles, of which probably nearly half of them are Puritan titles. So we carry, well, not quite half, but about 700 of Puritan titles, and where we carry all of these at discount prices because we are a nonprofit. So we encourage listeners, even if someone comes on and hears this podcast and they want the book Living by God's Promises, they write to Reformation Heritage Books and say they heard it on your podcast, we'll give them a special price, a 50% discount to get them going, reading the Puritans. But most of our books are like 30 to 40% discount. So we're the place to get the books from and get them cheaply and give you good shipping and so on.
Well, that's appreciated. And of course, that website is heritagebooks.org, and a good one-stop place to pick up the Puritans for sure. And Dr. Beeke, we're about the halfway point. If you don't mind, we're going to take a short break and then come right back with our discussion, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Joel Beeke, we're discussing his book, Meet the Puritans. I'm going to take a short break and come right back after this message, and we'll continue.
In the 17th century, John Bunyan gave us the character Mr. Valiant for Truth. In the 20th century, God gave us another Mr. Valiant for Truth, J. Gresham Machen, the founder of Westminster Seminary. The spirit of Machen lives on at Westminster Seminary, California, where for 30 years we've been fulfilling his vision of preparing men for ministry and teaching them to be expert in the Bible. WSCAL.edu, 888-480-8474, Westminster Seminary, California, for Christ, his gospel, and his church.
Back on the Reformed Cast, episode 13, with Dr. Joel Beeke, our very special guest, and we are discussing his book, Meet the Puritans. And Dr. Beeke, I wanted to ask about a very special Puritan called Richard Baxter. And of course, he's very special for more than one reason, obviously. And I wanted a little bit of your input on how Richard Baxter has had such a great impact on Puritan reading and his Christian Directory, and just phenomenal writer and mind. And yet he did not hold to a complete Reformed theology, at least from what is reported. Could you shed any light on that kind of a phenomenon, if you don't mind me calling it that?
Yes. Yes, well, Richard Baxter is a bit of an oxymoron theologically among the Puritans, because he did not really hold to what we would call a sound Reformed view on the doctrine of justification. He held to a view that is kind of a theological mix. Sometimes it's called the neo-nomianism. Neo means new, and nomos means law. So a new law. And basically what he said was that God has made a new law offering forgiveness to repentant breakers of the old law. And so faith and repentance then become new laws that must be obeyed. And they become the believer's personal saving righteousness that is sustained by preserving grace. And so this new law teaching, most of the Puritans thought was quite dangerous, that it moved away from sovereign grace only and salvation. And so Baxter and a number of the other Puritans went back and forth in all kinds of pamphlet wars and things like that. Now, the good news is that today, nobody is reading Baxter's treatises that are impinging themselves upon the theological constructs of salvation. What we do read of Baxter today are all his practical works about Christian living, how to live godly, pursue piety, his cases of conscience, which are contained in things like Christian Directory, or we read books like his Call to the Unconverted, which is very powerful and moving. Now, Baxter, therefore, has this good side to him, this very good side to him, a practical emphasis, but he's also got the negative side. So you just have to use a little caution, but most of the books that are printed by Baxter today are the good ones, not the ones that will lead you astray. So he can still have a really good positive impact on people today in the practical Christian living realm.
Okay, great. I noticed that some of the work that is out there is of that nature, and at least the most public work, and I guess that's a good thing. And on the subject of dangerous reading, I wanted to ask you a question about how some readers take the Puritans when they're first coming to the Puritans, or maybe they're new to Reformed theology as a whole, and they read them and the emphasis on perseverance, which is, of course, vital for the believer. But there's, I guess there's a certain context, they can, at least in some of the reading that I've done, and again, hasn't been a whole lot, but I know one particular individual I was kind of troubled by, and I don't recall the Puritan author offhand, off the top of my head, but they were troubled by the almost going over the line on certain aspects of justification and sanctification. How do you avoid the dangers when you're reading and studying theological works of the Puritans so that you don't get confused? I'm talking about a believer that is not really, you know, they might have come out of the charismatic movement and might not have the correct biblical idea of eternal security. What would you say to them as they read the Puritans in that regard?
Well, I would say I've got good news for you. 99% of the Puritans are thoroughly sound. The unsound minority, really, for the most part, has never been reprinted. And that actually applies even to Baxter. But in terms of his books that are the most unsound, they just haven't been reprinted. In fact, in the 19th century, when they reprinted 22 volumes of Baxter's, 150 volumes, they called it the practical works, and they just picked out all the good practical works. So that's the beautiful thing about reading the Puritans. There's hardly any danger at all, because almost every Puritan you can lay your hands on is thoroughly sound and well balanced.
That's wonderful news. I know that the Puritans themselves, and even that word itself, has gotten some real, it's taken a lot of hits, not just by the Christian community, but by the non-Christian community as well, in terms of, you know, almost as a pejorative. And I wanted to kind of move and talk a little bit about that, if possible. How did that all develop, and especially in America, about this, and I know it happened in England too, but this just pejorative attitude towards the Puritans? Obviously, it's based on a lot of stereotypes and misunderstandings, but where did that all kind of originate?
Well, the word Puritan was first used in the 1560s by the enemies of the Puritans, who thought that they were, you know, too strong on living totally for God in every detail of life. And so they said, oh, you guys are just Puritans. And so William Perkins, the founder of Puritanism, or maybe not the founder, but often called the father of Puritanism, he said this is a vile term and to be rejected, because he thought it meant that they were being accused of perfectionistic tendencies. But the name stuck. And it stuck for this reason, I think, because it was the Puritans' goal to purify the church, to purify their own lives by the grace of God, to walk holy before the Lord in every area of their lives. And what you find now is that people will have a derogatory opinion of the Puritans because they're going by what they heard from 19th century sources, in which some people, I mean, think of Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, began to, in a sly way, accuse the Puritans of being overly religious, overly strict, and things like that. But in the 20th century, for people who are in the know, scholarship, even secular scholars, have discovered that the Puritans were actually very happy people with happy family life. They actually had solid Christian homes. They bequeathed to us the Christian home where husbands and wives stay in love romantically. Romance really came from the Puritan poets within marriage. And they just, what we think of as a solid, loving Christian fellowship around the family table, and parents' interest in the lives of their children, and children obedient to their parents. The ideal of the Christian home, we owe that to the Puritans. Puritans, as far as I know, and I've studied church history for several decades, were the happiest group of people that I've ever seen in society, because they were living closest to the purpose for why we were here on earth, that is to live for the glory of God. So ever since the 1920s, when Perry Miller came along, and Woodhouse and other scholars of a secular nature, and reassessed the Puritans and found that these caricatures of the 19th century were just that, caricatures, both secular and religious historians have been changing that false image. The problem is that the people who still have this false image of the Puritans are precisely the people who never read the Puritans, and they're still going by long outdated 19th century put-downs.
Okay, and what you just said a minute ago reminded me of the book that describes the Puritans as a happy lot of people that that enjoyed life. That book, Worldly Saints, by Leland Ryken, comes to mind. That kind of describes what you just described. You probably,
can I say a word about that book?
Yeah, absolutely.
That is the best introductory book about the Puritans, if you want an overall view, I think, that's ever been written. It quotes them, it lets them talk in their own words, it's simple, it addresses them in most areas of life. I think that's a very good place to begin if you're going to read about the Puritans.
Great. I know that I've gone through that book and I found it tremendously helpful in terms of, it divided it into different parts of their life, how it affected their family life, their marriage, and all those kind of things, and that they were people that had fun and certainly enjoyed life, and were not the caricature of the solemn, everything is terrible kind of a caricature that you tend to, or people have tended to associate with Puritanism. It really, I think, does a good job in dispelling that, and thank you for elucidating on that. On the program, because I agree, having read it, it's tremendously helpful. If I could, I wanted to move over to talk a little bit about the Westminster Assembly, if I could. I'm gonna pronounce that Westminster. I always have a problem with that. Somebody pointed out that I called it Westminster, and which I have, and so now I'm making a conscious effort not to do that. probably not the first one. And on, I know that many, many Puritans were on the Westminster Assembly, who, of course, drafted and completed the confession, the Westminster Confession. And would you be able, would you say comfortably that because of that, Presbyterianism and Puritanism is really of so closely linked that you really can't do one without the other, so to speak? In other words, there's different expressions of Reformed theology out there. Not all of them include the Puritan emphasis. And what can you say about that, the mere fact that they were on the Westminster Assembly? Doesn't that speak volumes about how you really have a difficult time, you know, bifurcating Reformed theology from Puritanism when all said and done?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, I know.
Let me say this, a couple of things. First of all, there were some divines at the Westminster Assembly, like Thomas Goodwin, who were not Presbyterian. And there was a handful. And they created quite a bit of trouble in the minds of the others, because they were quite talkative. But for the most part, yes, the Puritans were Presbyterian, and they were closely associated with the whole movement of Presbyterianism. But what we need to understand is the thing called, in church history, second-generation phenomenon. And what I mean by that is this, that when you have a movement that revives things in a biblical direction, and people get godly and concerned to live scripturally, the second generation often grows cold. The kids often grow up taking it for granted and that type of thing. So what happens then is there's a reaction to that coldness, and a new group of people spring up, desirous to live for the glory of God. That's what the Puritans are. Reformers came along in a wonderful Reformation revival, if you want to call it that. The second generation grew lukewarm, and then the Puritans came along really as the third generation of the Reformation and said, we want to be thoroughly reformed. We don't want to change any Reformation doctrines. We do want to fine-tune our church polity. We do want to maybe develop a few doctrines further, like covenant theology and adoption and assurance of faith. So they did things like that. But the main goal of the Puritans was to say, the Reformers got the doctrines right, but they were so energetic and so concentrating to get the doctrines right, they didn't have enough time to really to develop all these doctrines to show how they impacted our private lives. Calvin said we must live all of life for the glory of God, but how to do that as a baker, how to do it as a Christian wife? He didn't have time to write whole treatises on that. So the Puritans came along and said, we're going to take the Reformation doctrine and we want to apply it to every area of life. How can we live holy before God and surrender this area to God and live to His glory? That was the passion of the Puritans. Now, in that process, then Presbyterianism was one more area where they were trying to refine themselves and live for the glory of God. So they tried to find the most biblical form of church government.
Well, that's well explained. I appreciate that explanation. That really clarifies in my mind, and I'm sure in the mind of the listeners, of how all this kind of comes together and the second generation phenomenon. That great info. I'll tell you. I think we tend to, at least any of us, if we're not careful, when we look. When we're studying history, we have a tendency to kind of miss those kind of nuances. And there you go. I guess there's really not too much more I can say about that. I guess lastly, if I could ask you about the Puritans and the Pilgrims and their influence on America, their longstanding influence. You know, there's some that actually credit the Puritans for their economic the way of life and how that worked itself out in America, you know, later on. How important was the Puritans to the establishment of America? You know, we have the benefit of hindsight now, but what are your thoughts about that, Dr. Beakey?
Well, Puritanism as a movement actually began to wane in the early 1700s. Often Jonathan Edwards is called the last Puritan, and he died in 1758. So when our country actually was founded, Puritanism was considered to be on the way out. On the other hand, so many things about Puritanism and so many of their teachings did impact America and still does to some degree. For example, the work ethic in America is better even today than it is in many countries around the world. And that's certainly we owe to the Puritans in large measure, a strong work ethic, because the principle there was, again, to live to the glory of God and to work as unto God and not as unto men. So when your boss left, you didn't slacken your work at all because you were dedicated to God in your work. The whole area of marriage and viewing your wife as someone that you give your love to under Christ, and that you are to love her as Christ loved the church, and the woman is to respect and submit to her husband as the church, as the believer submits and respects the Lord Jesus Christ, or to the church. So, I'm sorry, to the Lord Jesus Christ, yes, because the church is the bride. Now, that whole concept we are losing in America today, but it was there for quite a while, and marriages were built on that. And I think in many churches, certainly in my church, our whole concept of marriage and among my 700 people and child rearing and obedience from children to parents and so on is still greatly influenced by the Puritans. In fact, I even teach a class about family living, and I have whole lessons on this very subject, what the Puritans teach us about marriage and family. So the Christian home, the solid Christian home, is bequeathed to us by the Puritans, the work ethic, any remnant we have left the whole concept of service in different areas of life. Puritans saw their lives to be of service. The whole spirit of generosity in America, of giving to other nations and giving donations to good causes, that benevolence, we owe a lot of that to the Puritans. So you could make a checklist and tick off, I think, a pretty lengthy list of things that we really owe to the Puritans today.
Great, Dr. Beakey, and just as we're about to wrap up, I wanted to ask you. I know you mentioned your another book, "Living by God's Promises," that you co-authored. I guess you said with James LaBelle. Excuse me. And what else is going on as far as some of your printed works? Some of your new books on the horizon, or anything you want to tell the listeners about?
Yes. Well, I've got another book that R.C. Sproul just published, called that is Reformation Trust, his publishing wing, called Living for God's Glory. And I tried to show in that book how the Calvinists and the Puritans live each area of life for God's glory. I've got 8 other authors who join me, people like Sinclair Ferguson and Michael Haken. And we have 28 different areas that we look at to show how the Puritans and the Calvinists live for the glory of God. It's called The Introduction to Calvinism. Then I have another book called Puritan Reform Spirituality, which I trace the piety that Calvin was so fond of, and I trace that, how that was influenced the Puritans and then the Dutch divines and the Scottish divines as well. And presently, I'm working on a book that will go to press next week on the prayer life of the Reformers and the Puritans. That's about 12 chapters, looking at different individuals and their teaching on prayer. So that's the next project. And then one more I just quickly mentioned. Mark Jones and I are presently writing the very first Puritan theology textbook. that's going to be used for colleges and seminary level, especially seminaries, I think, beginning seminary students. So we're hoping to have 28 chapters in that book, looking at 28 different doctrines of what the Puritans taught by.
Well, that's great. And that last title, when is that expected to be released? Do you have any idea?
Well, our goal is to have it to the printer in March, so probably May of next year.
That's fantastic. And, of course, Living for God's Glory, you mentioned, that's available at your books. No, it isn't.
Yes, Sproul published it, but it's available from our bookstore. It's a $24 book. I think we sell it for $18.
Great, and the others you mentioned we'll be on the lookout for, and I'm sure the listeners will be too. The one you mentioned, Puritan Reform of Spirituality, I have that one, and haven't completed it yet, but another great one. I really appreciate your work, and I know the listeners do, and I want to thank you very much for coming on the program. I know you have a busy schedule. You just come off a whole bunch of conferences, and just thank you very much for taking the time today, Dr. Beacon, to come on and talk about the Puritans like this.
Okay, thank you very much, brother.
Dr. Joel Beakey, and we were discussing his book, Meet the Puritans, and of course, as he mentioned, he has several other titles already out and also some in the works. So you can visit his bookstore at heritagebooks.org for the titles. Great to have him on. Really appreciate the fact that he took the time out to come on. So that concludes that. And next week, we will have the privilege of having Dr. Guy Prentice Waters on the program to discuss the doctrine of justification. So we'll look forward to that next week on episode 14. Also, please be aware that there will be no podcast December 27th. Due to the Christmas holiday that week. That's that week where everybody's away, where we're not going to do a podcast, and we'll rest up and then we'll be back. And please, reformedcast.com, you can visit for the upcoming episodes and also the archives of the past episodes. Please visit us there on our newly designed website. We'll look forward to being here again next week with Dr. Guy Waters. So until then, have a great week, and so long for now.